Okay, you can start again.
Nobody has the right to punish anybody but me. I want you to come to me and tell me what's going on, and I will be the one who will punish. The following day, we went out to work, and exactly the same thing was going on, what happened the day before, and this officer, this new guy, he came out and he didn't talk to anybody, he was just walking up and down, and he looked around and he saw exactly what was going on. In the evening, when we walked in, he never said supper. After supper, he called us out, everybody out. So he said, was there anything happening today? And at this point, the whole group, everybody, stepped out. Yes, I was beaten by this guy, I was beaten by that guy, and so on and so on. So he turned to that little short soldier. He wasn't even a soldier, he was he had some rank, you know, he wasn't an officer yet, but he was going to school to become an officer, and he told him, he said, you, of all people, you should know better when you are getting an order that you are not supposed to hit or beat up anybody. And that was an order from me, I'm your superior. And if you are going to do this once more, I warn you, I'm going to court-martial you, and it will cost you your life. Because these people are here to work and to produce, not to be beaten. And this goes to everybody. If you have any complaints against the Jews, you come to me and let me know. And we just couldn't believe it. We just couldn't get over it that something like that could happen. And unfortunately, a lot of us have decided they are sacred and feared. The next day, no, half of them didn't even go out to work. You know, they thought, you know, that they don't have to do it anymore because this was a relief. And we had a very, very beautiful, I would say about 6 weeks while this man was there. And all of a sudden, there was a complete changeover. A different man came in and he took over, and this guy was released. We actually cried like children when the guy left.
Was he taken out because he didn't beat you, or do you know that was the main reason?
That must have been the main reason. We actually don't know. I can't testify that yes, he was taken out because he was good to the Jews, but that must have been the only reason, because they sent back a man who was even worse than the one before him. Even worse. But fortunately enough, it was already September, and the Russian army started pushing again. And they had no choice, so we had to pack up, and we started walking. And we walked through the mountains, miles and miles and miles without stopping, and we kept on going. A lot of them they couldn't go any further, and they were left there. Some of them were shot, some of them were left there laying in the ditches, and they probably some of them survived like that. And whoever was able to walk, we kept on walking
back towards where you were from?
Back towards Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And we arrived about 2 days before Rosh Hashanah in 1944. We arrived into Hungary, into a big city. It was called Vestetze.
What part of Hungary was that?
That was part of Transylvania. Part of Transylvania.
From your region.
From our region, that's right. We were very familiar. And that's the first time, actually, when we did find out that there are no Jews left in Hungary, because they had a tremendous big Jewish population over there, and there was nobody, absolutely nobody left.
The name of that city was what? It doesn't matter. It was a bigger city than your city?
No, smaller. In Romania, and I went to them, called Mestece, So anyway, we were put in there again in a big school yard, and at this point the Russian army must have been coming very, very fast, because they had a tremendous big German population in this town and the whole region,
mm-hmm.
who lived there all their life. They were not from Germany, but they were German origins, you know, like their ancestors came from, and they spoke mostly German instead of Hungarian or Romanian,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's what their mother tongue. And they were all running away from the Russians, because they were told that they are going to come back, and there were trains waiting for them, and we had to go and help them carry their belongings, whatever they wanted to take around. We had to help them carry it to the train and load the train for them, and that was our job, which was a very good job for us, because they gave us food, whatever they had left over, they threw it to us, and they gave it to us, and they thanked us for helping them board the train and carrying this stuff with them. And they were there for till after Yom Kippur. That was our job. And they, for the day of Yom Kippur, like Kor Nidre and the day of Yom Kippur, we were free. We didn't have to go out to work at all. We made a little synagogue for ourselves over there. As a matter of fact, there was one very religious Jewish man who was also from Transylvania, who did find, on the way coming back from Poland, he found there were so many Sefer Torahs, you know, thrown out in the streets, and you know, you couldn't carry them. There were hundreds and hundreds of them laying there, and he picked one up himself, you know, and he carried it along. He threw away his own belongings in order to bring the Torah along, which was very touchy, you know. And that was the Torah that he used for the services and for Yom Kippur. And that Cornelian night, stay with me. It was a very, very touchy corridor at the time. Funny thing that I can't cry, you know, I'm not the type of cry. I don't know why I brought it out to me right now. Can't help it. I'm sorry that.
Okay.
So anyway, that Cornelia night was the most touchiest Kol Nidre I ever had in all my life. And then a couple of days after Yom Kippur, we started walking again. And now this is something personal. It has nothing to do with thousands and thousands of others, but I'm sure that it happened to many others, like it happened to me. We were walking day and night without stopping and without food. And all of a sudden they told us that we are going to stop right here and we are going to stay overnight. And we were so glad, you know, that we were so tired that we just couldn't take it any longer. And I took my shoes off and I just lay down on the ground. And they didn't give us more than 5 minutes. They told us that we have to keep on going, continue going. And I tried to put my shoes on and I couldn't put them on anymore because evidently my feet must have been swollen or whatever. And I couldn't walk and I tried very hard to walk and I just couldn't make it. And I thought, you know, like I'm sure that you have the experience, like there were among all those thousands of people, there were four of us, very, very close to one another, very, very close, like really brothers, you know, we were very close to one another. One of them lives in Los Angeles. One of them lives in Australia, one of them is in Romania, and I'm here. And the four of us, we were very close to one another. And I told them that I give up, I just can't take it any longer. They picked me up and they carried me on their shoulders. Carried me like that all night long, and then in the morning somehow I got strength enough, put my shoes back on, and we kept on walking, and we walked till late in the afternoon, and we were already still in Transylvania, but it was already getting very close to the Hungarian border. The old Hungarian border, because this was Hungary at the time, you know, now I'm talking to you about. We were getting very close to the Hungarian border and we knew it, that this is the end, regardless whatever happens, they are not taking us over there just to, because they love us so much, you know, they are taking us there for a reason, and we decided definitely not to go any further. And we stopped in a small little village. And since we spoke the language, naturally we had no difficulties talking to the peasants who lived there, and we wanted to find out exactly what's going on. And they told us that they advised us not to go any further because they heard it, that the Russians are very, very close by, and we should try and hide if we had a possibility. And they gave us directions how to go into the forest from right there. And we spent the whole night in that little village. And roughly about 70 of us decided that we are going to take off and go, thinking if they catch us, all they can do is kill us. That's the worst that can happen. So what if we don't make a deal? Sooner or later, that's the end of it anyway, so might as well. And we went into the forest, and to our biggest surprise, how it happened, nobody ever knew. But four of the soldiers who were with us, watching us, and they had their guns, they were behind us and they came along with us. And they gave out the guns to us. As a matter of fact, I personally had one gun in my hand. They didn't want to keep it because they were in uniform. They were just in raggedy clothes, you know, we had no uniforms or something like that. And they were all coming along was already in October. And that's when the soldiers told us that the Hungarians, there was like the president or whatever you want to call him, the chief in command of the Hungarian government, was a man by the name Horthy. I'm sure you heard of the name Horthy, and that he is under arrest, and the Milos Guard, that was the most anti-Semitic group of the Hungarians, took over, and this is the end of the Jews, and they are murdering Jews by the thousands. And we were already in the forest, hiding over there, and we were there for 6 days. Now, as far as the food is concerned, some of them had a loaf of bread, and there were a lot of peasants who ran away from home themselves, and they were there with their, they brought their cows along, and you know, and they gave us a little milk, and they gave us a little bread, and we were kept alive there for 6 days. And after 6 days, two Hungarian peasants walked by there, and we didn't know, you know, because we were hiding in the forest, and we saw them, they are coming in, and we didn't know who they are, and we ran over, and I had a gun, one of the guns, you know, was in my hands, and we ran over, and we stopped them, and we told them that you tell us where you are going, otherwise we are going to kill you, because you know where we are, and we want to know exactly who you are and what you do. So they told us that the Russian army is right here in the valley, and they sent us to find out whether there are any Germans hidden around here, because they don't want to get killed, you know, unnecessarily, and that's why they sent us two peasants to find out the spy. And they knew who we were, you know, they didn't know that we are there, you know, but they knew that we are Jews and so on, so they told us that if we want to go to the Russians are right there, just a couple of miles away from there. So naturally we all took off and we walked right into them. And the Russian soldiers, when they saw us, they ran over and grabbed the gun, and they told that I'm one of the Nazis or somewhere, you know, and I told them that I'm Jewish and so on, and what took place, and they were handling us very rough, very, very rough, and they didn't trust anybody. Which in a way you can't blame them, you know, and they searched us, and they took everything, whatever little thing, whatever we had, if anybody had a good pair of shoes or something, they took it away. They took everything away from us, and then they told us that they are going to take us down into the little village, and they are turning us over to the Russian command, which they did. After they took everything away from us, they took us down, and they turned us over to, there was the Russian commandatur, whatever you call it, they took us over there, and they started questioning us. We were not able to talk to them. There were a couple of guys that came from somewhere, from Czechoslovakia, and they spoke a little bit of the language, but not enough, you know, to make them really understand, but they had more of an idea what it is all about. And they threw us into a, they took us for about 50 miles from there. We had to walk with them, and almost the same way like with the Hungarians, you know, but it was a little different story already, because that part we knew already that we are free, you know. And they threw us into a camp, and there were at least 100,000 Hungarians, Germans, Jews. Everybody was thrown in there and surrounded by Russian soldiers with machine guns. And thought, my God, we couldn't figure it out what they wanted was going to happen. But very fortunately, after 2 days, a major, a Russian major came in and he wanted to know whether there are any Jewish people around here, and actually we all ran over and we told him, yes, we are Jewish. And he started talking in Jewish, in a very fluent Jewish. He spoke to us and he told us that he is going to see to it that we should be freed and we can go home. And he would have been back. Sure enough, it didn't take him longer than about an hour or so. He came back and he said, now it is up to you guys, because I don't know who is Jewish, who is not Jewish. You are the ones who have to select, because I want strictly the Jews. I don't want Nazis free. And to the best of our knowledge, you know, we tried to select them, you know, and those four soldiers that were with us, we took them in as Jewish, you know, because they were very, very, very nice to us, you know. And so we were, they opened the gate and they let us out. And we were walking all the way. I was about 200 miles away from my hometown, which was probably a little more than 200 miles. And that 200 miles was again very, very difficult, because we had to walk barefooted, actually, you know, we had no shoes or something like that. And there were no roads built like here, you know, there were just great roads, and we were actually bleeding here, you know, but we were free.
It was winter too, wasn't it?
It was cold. It wasn't winter yet. There was no snow on the ground yet, you know, but it was the end of October, not the middle of October. So it was a very chilly night and so on, but it wasn't, there was no freezing, so we could stand it. And we walked all the way until finally we made it home, and we got home, and I call it a home. There was nothing, my mother, my sisters, everybody was gone, and all the Jews, everybody was gone. And in my hometown, I found at that time when I got home, it must have been around the 20th of October or so, 21st, there were about 5 Jewish people who also survived somehow, somewhere, you know, along the line, and they were home already, and we were the next group, you know. And naturally we started organizing a little committee, and we took ourselves a room in the Jewish Community Center, and we started organizing and find out what's going on with the rest of them, and if there is anybody coming home, we started collecting a little food here and there, you know, in order to make it easier for the others who are coming in. And which was a very, very fulfilling, you know, it was a good feeling, you know, that you are free again and you are able to help people and so on. Which was a very good feeling for all of us. And by the end of the year, around the end of December, we had quite a few people, a few hundred people that came back, and we were all like one family, you know, we were all together, and some of them knew how to cook, and we, you know. And I had one of my sisters who lived there, her apartment was taken by a Hungarian woman, and she lived there by herself. And when I came home, actually I went over first to my house where I lived with my mother and one of my sisters. And that house was totally ransacked, nothing left in there, and only a few pictures here and there, but no furniture or anything. And my sister's house was left about this woman who lived there, and she, when I told her who I was, then she got very frightened. She thought that I'm going to kill her or do anything like that to her, but she happened to be an innocent bystander. You know, they gave her the apartment and told her, you can walk in and it is yours. And when I told her who I was, then she apologized to me, and she told me that she, if there is anything she would do, whatever I want to, she's going to cook for me and wash and so on. And I told her that I don't need her help, but she doesn't have to worry, and if she hasn't got any place to go, there were two bedrooms, she can stay there and so on. And I invited all my friends over to my house, because this was already, you know, a ready home, you know. And we felt very good, and we were felt secure, even though that the Russians, they didn't trust anybody, and no matter whether you are Jewish or whatever, it was sometimes dangerous to go out in the street, even during the day, not talking about the night, but during the day. They just had sometimes, you know, they sent out a whole bunch of soldiers, and they grabbed people in the street, and they wandered in, took them to the rail station, and they took them away, just like that. And unfortunately, there were quite a few Jewish people who fell into something like that. Very unfortunately, they came back home, all of them, you know, whoever I knew of, that they were taken away again by the Russians, but they all came back about a month later or so. They just took them to some labor camp to work. But there was no exception because you are Jewish or because you are Gentile or whatever. They grabbed people in the street and just threw them in there and go. So we had our bad times too, but it was beyond comparison to what was going on before, naturally. And then in January and February, more and more and more people started coming in, and we were already organized. We had a Jewish community center, and we had a home, and we were very happy, and we got together, and even those Gentiles who were very, very mean, which we did find out during the period when they took all the Jews in roughly in May of 1944. They were very, very rude to the Jews. After we came home, now I don't know because they were afraid or whatever reason there was, but they were really trying to make up, you know, for whatever they did wrong. And they were very nice to us. They gave us food and stuff like that. We didn't want to accept it because at that point we really didn't need it anymore, because the Romanian border was just a few miles away from us, and there, you know, and at that point there was no border anymore. You could walk and you could go, you could do anything you wanted to, and we had plenty of food and everything else. And as a matter of fact, a lot of Romanian Jews who lived on the other side, you know, and they were not deported, they moved into Colozar, and they came over there, and they opened a little business here and there, and restaurants and stuff like that. And it was already rolling, you know, and it was getting to be easier and easier as we went along. And then I'm trying to concentrate, you know, as much as possible to think back of dates. I would say it must have been sometimes in March, where in all larger cities they were organized the same way, like we had our own committee. Like Neumarod, which I mentioned to you already, had already organized a bigger committee. They had a larger community, a large Jewish population. More people came home over there to that city than to ours. And somehow the hero, nobody's land actually, Transylvania. At that time, it was still Hungary, but it was Romania, it was Hungary, so it didn't belong anywhere. But the Romanians took it for granted that it belongs to them again, the same way like it was before the war. And the Romanian government offered the comedian Nagyvárad a train, with a complete train, and providing if there are enough volunteers or whoever is going to be delegated by them to go into Poland to the part that was liberated already, and bring home, there are a lot of Jews that were deported, you know, and they go and bring them back, and they gave us a special train, and I was one of the very fortunate people. There were two of us total from my hometown, a total of 24 from all over the Transylvania, from this territory, total of 24, two were taken from our hometown, and I was one of the two. The other one lives in Israel, his name is Paul Sigeti, very dear, close friend of mine. He also was in a camp. I was not together with him during the war, you know, but he was also in one of those labor camps, and he was home, and the two of us were delegated to this train, and they gave us a little sort of a passport without pictures in it, and it was made out in different languages, like in Hungarian, and German, and Russian, and Romanian, and Polish. But we are asking all authorities, wherever we go, to help us out and do anything, whatever we are asking for, in order to bring the Jews back from Poland. And we went to Poland, and but I don't recall exactly whether it was March or April. Probably it was already the first part of April, the first time that the train took off. And we had enough supplies, like food and medication and so on, and we had two doctors that were also in the delegation, Jewish guys who were also in labor camps, and they returned home. And we went to Poland, and we went as far as Krakow. And that was the end station for our train. We stayed right there. And from Krakow, we were sent out two or four delegates to different places, like to Auschwitz, which was already liberated at the time, and so on. Now, I happened to be the first time I was sent to Auschwitz, Birkenau. And it was extremely, extremely interesting to go in, and we had a guide that also came along on the train. He was a Polish Jew who was working in the concentration camp from 1942 till the liberation. He was working in the death camp, actually, you know, he knew every corner, and he came along with us. And it was extremely interesting at this point that he pointed out to us exactly where the crematoriums were, and some of them were still standing, naturally out of order, but they were still standing, and some of them were completely destroyed. And as a matter of fact, I took some pictures. That friend of mine in Israel has quite a few pictures. I have a couple or three of them. And there were, I would say, about 100 Jewish leftovers, Jewish people leftovers in the hospital. And they took food along with us, and we gave it to them. And it was an experience that it will stay with me for the rest of my life. It is really something so fulfilling that it is unbelievable. You know, it is really unbelievable. You got to see it to believe what was going on there. How those old people, have you ever seen a skeleton? Those were actual skeletons, still alive. How they were able to walk around or even move around, I don't know, but they were actual skeletons. I don't know the reason, probably you might know, they called them the Muslim, that's what they called them, over there, not skeletons, but they were actual skeletons. And when we walked in and we brought food to them, and they started clapping and crying and hugging us, and you know, it was so touchy that it was unbelievable, unreal. And whoever was able, and they were from Romania or Hungary, and they wanted to come along, or they were able to come along, we took them naturally along with us, and we took them back to the train, and over there the doctor started taking care of them already, you know, and it was a different atmosphere naturally. And we were there for about 4 or 5 days, and we had a train full of people already. We had about 700 Jewish people, and we took them back home to Romania, and we stayed home for about a week or so, and the train came back, and we went back and forth. I made a trip 4 times, okay? And one out of the 4 times was the most interesting, when this friend of mine, this Paul Sigeti, now he is still alive, as a matter of fact, I just got a letter from him, we are corresponding, I talk to him over the phone every once in a while. And he and myself were sent from Krakow to take a Polish train and go to Lodz, that was a large Jewish city. I mean, it was a Polish city, but a large Jewish population. And to go look around if there are any Hungarian or Romanian Jews, to bring them back to the train, and we are going to take them home. And on the train, never will I that forget, it was jammed. So many people, thousands and thousands of people were in that Polish train. And we saw that two women sitting in the corners, very nice looking, nicely, very neatly dressed, and you could tell on their faces they are entirely different. They are not, they don't belong there. And we couldn't figure it out. And Paul and myself, we went over to them and started talking, and at first they didn't know who we were, and naturally they didn't want to talk. And we told them that we don't have to worry because we are Jewish, and we told them exactly what our mission is. And somehow they did believe us, and they told us that they are also Jewish. And they were in several camps and hiding, and they are home already for the last 2 months, and they live in a lodge with their husbands, and they are so skeptical of anybody who ever talks to them because they didn't know what it is all about, but they believed us. We are telling them the truth. And it was about 6 o'clock in the morning by the time we got into the lodge, and we took a cab, it was actually a horse-driven carriage. And we took that carriage, and we had rockets with us, you know, Paul and myself, we carried whiskey and cigarettes. Because that was the only thing that you could do anything with, you know. Money was absolutely meaningless at the time, you know. And we carried a big, huge suitcase, one myself and one he did, and we got into this horse and this carriage with the two women, and we went to their house, and the husbands were home, and the husbands didn't know out, and they got scared at first, and then they told them who they are, and naturally they took us right in, and they came very handy to us, because naturally they spoke Polish fluently, they were born and raised there. And the guy's name was Gerl Ruben Herman, I'll never forget him. I got pictures downstairs with him at Hotel later, and he was this two brother-in-laws, you know, they were, the two of them were married to these two guys, and they lived together in this apartment. So they came very, very handy to us, because we ate breakfast, we had breakfast right there in their house, and then we went out, and there was a Jewish community already working in Lodz. And there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Philip Friedman, who later became a very famous man. He was a professor here at Columbia University in New York. And he was the head of the Jewish community over there. And he was one hell of a man, a very fine gentleman. And he treated us royally. He was very, very nice to us. And he told us, he didn't want to get involved in it naturally, but he told us that that is in a school, and he gave this two guys, you know, the exact address where they are. There are about 50 Hungarian Jewish women. They are locked up by the Russians, and there is no way to get them out, because they don't know what truth they are killing them there for, but they are locked in there and can't get them out. And he suggested for us that since we had all these documents to prove who we are and what we are, and it was made out also in Russian, that we should go to the Russian commander of the city and talk to them and see what we can accomplish. And which we did right away naturally, and these two guys were the ones who spoke for us, because we didn't know how to speak the Russian language, and they spoke Polish, evidently they spoke a little Russian also, and they explained it to them, and they were very kind, they listened to us, and they told us that they don't know of anything, of any Hungarian Jewish women, and there is nobody in there, and even if there would be anybody locked up for rent, there must be a reason for it, and Stalin would be the only person who can give you an authorization to release him. Nobody else. There is no way that they could release anybody. First of all, they denied it, that they don't know of anybody. Only Stalin would be the only one that would release me, and he would give me a writing that they should be released. Otherwise, there is no way. And they don't know anything about any Jewish women, whether they're Hungarian or Polish, they don't know of anybody like that. But Dr. Friedman told us exactly where they are located at. And we decided we are going to go out there and see what's going on. And sure enough,